You're listening to Crime Friction.
This is another podcast about Bigfoot and Elmore Leonard.
That could just be the intro right there.
I think it is. So I came across the Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom trailer the other day, and let's just start by talking about this title. Do you really feel that the Jurassic Park franchise is something that requires more than a number?
I'm curious about the Marvel now. Numbers don't exist for Marvel, but we still talk about them in terms of numbers. Like, we go like, are you going to watch Avengers 3, Avengers 4? But, you know, they're like, oh no, it's got to be Avengers the Falling of the Wizardy Woo. I don't even know if that's the title. But when did we stop having numbers for?
I don't know. And you know what? I'm gonna go back to hey, did you know I teach, Jay? I two schools of
thought. Literally taking a drink right now.
Die Hard. Die Hard was Die Hard 1. You know, Die Hard, and then Die Hard 2, and then it became like
Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Yeah, and they started using words and. Lethal Weapon, they were all numbers.
Yeah.
And there was a certain, like, shift. I think Lethal Weapon 4 and Die Hard 3 are about the same time period coming out, and that's where the shift to the titles came in.
You can see it in the Mission Impossible movies, because it's Mission Impossible, Mission Impossible 2, Mission Impossible 3, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol.
Ghost Protocol. And I don't get it.
I suppose the devil's advocate on it, and this is where, this is, like, part of me, maybe 25% of me likes it, is because it's a way of saying that this isn't just Mission Impossible 3 or whatever.
Well, then
it's,
don't make Mission Impossible 3.
That this is another story in that world. Like, books would have different titles. So I like that, but 75% of me hates it.
So Fallen Kingdom, I assume that it's some sort of, like, Tyrannosaur round table. There's going to be swords. If there's no wizards, I'm walking out of this movie.
Wasn't the last Transformers film like a King Arthur film with Transformers in it?
Oh, the last Transformers film was epic because it was obviously a bunch of screenwriters who are being paid ridiculous amounts of money and had completely given up on this franchise. And one was like, okay, let's do pyramids, but also King Arthur and a dragon, and just put them all together. And you could tell how much fun the screenwriters had. Like, I bet they called their friends like, hey, Mark, you know, what do you want me to put in this movie? What movie? Doesn't matter.
The kid who brings the coffee in, and they're just like, yeah. What should we do in act three?
Werewolves. Okay, great idea. And I mean, it just was fun to me because it was just, no one was trying, but it came across in a positive, not really trying way, as opposed to the, I don't want to be doing this, which is kind of what I felt with the Jurassic World, the last one, not the forthcoming Fallen Kingdom. I read that the screenwriter had never even seen the first Jurassic Park, which strikes me as odd for a million reasons, but also the fact that he took the first movie, put all of the parts in a bowl, shook it up, and then just made the same movie again, but really, 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 really worse.
It felt like he'd rewritten the trailer of the first Jurassic
Park. Like, all of the elements were there just in the wrong order, and it was really kind of disconcerting to me.
It's a really bad film.
Well,
the,
you
the
know...
fact that, like, they keep the T-Rex hidden in this box throughout the whole film, and it's only at the end when they sort of go, oh, hey, we've got a T-Rex. What?
I was really disappointed because Jurassic Park, I loved that movie. I loved that movie so much. And so I was really excited when they relaunched the franchise, and I could not wait. And I was disappointed would be an understatement when I saw that movie. And then I was on a plane and I decided to watch it again because, you know, I'm trapped in a small box and I figured, why not torture myself? And I finally figured it out. If you rewatch the movie, and you know, the raptors, and the lead raptor in the raptor group is called Blue. Every time I hear it, I think that. And if you watch it as with Blue as the protagonist, this is Blue's story. the entire thing actually falls into place. Now, I'm not saying it becomes a good movie. I'm just saying it starts to make sense.
It does. It's like how suddenly the act structure of Jaws makes sense if you think about the shark as the protagonist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it fell into place with Blue as the protagonist, and I'm like, you know what? This isn't that horrible. Wasn't good. I mean, especially when they have like, oh my god, that aquatic dinosaur that. Ugh. But that should have been great. If I described to you the dinosaur, you'd be 1,000% on board. Like, now they're in the water. Like, we'd be excited about this. And so to have a character, I guess, being the dinosaur, that great and misuse them so badly, mm-hmm. just made it worse. Like the camouflage dinosaur, that really should have, you know, been a much larger plot point. It really only worked, what, the once?
Yes. That was a point from the second book.
Yes, it was.
Which was a brilliant,
they could go against the
scene.
Fence, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's just that wonderful tense build-up to when they realize there's been a dinosaur there the whole time watching them. And it's amazing. But in the film, nah.
Yeah, no, they completely ruined it. I mean, they have these great setups. And then, like, the faux Hammond guy, you know, like, the billionaire who just decided he can fly a helicopter. And then, like, what was that side point?
Yep. Oh, and he's dead now.
Yeah, he's dead now. Oh, great. Thanks.
Although I do have an issue with the first film, even though it's a masterpiece up to a point. Jurassic Park was brilliant up until the moment they spend the whole film teaching us, like Steven Spielberg's obsession with the crocodile in Peter Pan. They spent the whole film teaching us that you can hear a T-Rex coming because you've got the impact tremors. And then right at the end of the film, a T-Rex sneaks up on people inside a building. Like, was it wearing slippers? And I mean, you can say, okay, the people were distracted, they're facing away from the T-Rex. Okay, but the velociraptors, who are also apex predators, are facing towards the direction that this big 40-foot monster is running, and it sneaks up and eats one of them. How?
I have no idea.
And it's a brilliant film up until that point, and it's a brilliant film after that for the, you know, the brief seconds.
Well, and that scene is great. It's just logical. It's just a logical fallacy based on the world. Yeah.
The book teased references to dinosaurs getting off the island.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I can't remember if it was the velociraptors or something. And there's a scene when they're talking about them lining up and sneaking, or like
I think it was the compies. Was it the compies or the raptors?
I think it might have been the compies. And there's just these nice teased references to all of the places they could have gone, and they went none of them. Let's play with a world where dinosaurs exist again. Let's play with that world.
Well, but you know, actually, I thought movies did a lot of things wrong. But like, let's talk about the compies for a second, because in a weird way, they were the most disturbing of all of the creatures in that, at least in the first book, to me, because they watched and waited, and they appeared completely innocent until some small thing would go wrong. Mm-hmm. And then they would essentially, like, converge as a hive mind upon you and start ripping you apart.
They're like cats, basically.
Exactly. So for all of the wonderful suspense that they put in the movie, I really felt ignoring that was a mistake. Because it was all the big things, you know?
It's always
been
spectacle over suspense with the films.
Yeah.
Even though the best, I mean, the T-Rex at the side of the road, that whole sequence
brilliant.
Is still the best thing they've ever done. And that was suspense and payoff.
Well, and actually, you know, the scene where Laura Dern, Ellie, runs to get to the electrical shack.
Oh, yeah.
That was also, and then she gets in there and has that moment of relief because she thinks Sam Jackson's still alive.
Yep.
And it's just so it's just on top of that suspense came that moment, and that was also brilliant.
Yes, the suspense and payoff, which is what Spielberg's always been great at. I mean, you were talking about them kind of shaking up and remixing all of the elements of the first film when they made Jurassic World, and they just seem to completely forget that bit. Apart from the moments in the paddock with the big stupid thing that can do all things, there's no clever girl moment,
and there's also no passion. Jurassic Park is a movie about passion. Mm-hmm. I know that sounds really weird, but you have, you know, Dr. Grant and Dr. Sattler, who are massively passionate about what they do, worried at any minute that their dig site's going to be shut down, you know, because they have to go beg for more money and that's not what they want to do, but they have to keep doing the thing that they love. So they're slightly compromising their principles to take this money and go to this place that John Hammond has created because he is so passionate about spectacle. You know, and then you have the scientist who is passionate about the genetic engineering, and you have and Ian Malcolm, who is passionate about pessimism.
Really liked leather.
And leather. Yeah, he really did. He really liked leather. But, you know, it's all of these people who have a passion for things. Oh, and Timmy, and don't get me started on the kids, because that was one of the, you know, in the book, it was the girl who was the computer mastermind, mm-hmm. Lexi.
Saved a bunch of people.
And in the movie, they switch the kids around and make Timmy the smart one and Lexi's a total idiot. And that drove me nuts.
Here's a weird epiphany. See, I like to say that I've had epiphanies when really what this process is over and over me realizing things that everyone else already knows. But I call them epiphanies. The way you've described the first film then of the passion and the compromises and all of these things. So could we say that the first Jurassic Park is a film about what filmmaking had been in the old Hollywood for Steven Spielberg?
Absolutely.
And Jurassic World is a film about filmmaking, but it's what filmmaking is now, when it's just getting a computer, throwing a bunch of shit together and seeing what happens.
I think that's sadly accurate. I mean, and the passion for nothing comes across in Jurassic World. Mm-hmm. I mean, even this new billionaire Hammond guy, like nobody, Nick from New Girl totally doesn't give a shit, and nor does anybody else.
And the only bit that does really mean anything is the Lone Ranger moment at the end with Blue.
Yeah, no, Blue as a character steps up. He's the only one who has any development, depth, and journey. And I am saying this about a Velociraptor.
And again, T-Rex in a box. Yeah. For a whole film that they just forget about. Clearly, I have issues with T-Rexes at the end of Jurassic Park films.
You really do. Nobody puts T-Rex in a box.
But what if there's an accident, it wouldn't be able to let itself out. It can't reach the...
Yeah, but now I'm seeing the Dirty Dancing poster with the little arms.
That's probably the end of the segment.
So, woof, woof.
All right, so we got many, 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 I don't know, many manys.
I think we have a few.
Plenty.
A plethora.
There were at least two people complained that Puppy P.I. hadn't been on the show for quite a while. So we brought Puppy P.I. back.
We've resurrected him.
There's been a new noir at the bar announced for Queens on June the 8th. There hasn't been a new Glasgow one announced yet, but there will be one around about then. This is almost an exclusive. So in light of that, we sent Puppy P.I. off to go and ask people what makes a good live reading.
I'm S.J. Roseanne. I'm the author of 15 novels, two more on the way, and about 75 short stories.
Hi, I'm Jedediah Ayers. I'm the host of Noir at the Bar in St. Louis and the author of Peckerwood, among other titles.
Hey, this is Alex Aguirre. I'm the author of the Pete Fernandez Miami Mystery Series. The latest installment of that series, Blackout, hits May 8th from Polis Books. I hope you take a minute to check it out.
I'm Josh Dollings, crime writer. My books include the Moses McGuire trilogy and my disco heist novel, Young Americans.
You know, I think reading in front of people can be tough and stressful, but it's also the kind of thing you can get better at much faster than you think.
The first thing I want to say should be obvious, but it often isn't. Pick something to read that is engaging to hear.
A great live reading is when the author connects with the audience, doesn't bury their head in the text, makes some eye contact, tells me a story.
Don't assume people know who you are. Don't assume they're familiar with your work. They're there to be entertained.
It should feel like hanging out in a bar or a coffee shop and hearing the greatest tale ever told, not like being read to.
How do you do this? Well, for one thing, once you've picked your piece, practice it.
Practice before the event. Take some time to read whatever piece of your work you selected.
Read it over and over and over the way you're going to read it at your public reading. Read it so often the cat gets sick of it and leaves the room. Make sure you know where the phrases and words are that you're going to stumble over, and change it.
I edit my book material so it works for readings.
Put in new words, I swear your readers will not know when they get there.
Think of it as a performance, like a theatrical performance where you're performing for the back of the house. You want everybody to get the effect of what you're saying versus, say, someone reading at home where they can really spend a lot of time concentrating on your beautiful prose. That's more like film acting, you know. It's the eye quiver. Don't worry about that in a live performance. Go with big ideas.
Practice is also really helpful when it sounds like you care. And by care, I mean you're reading like you care. If you ever listen to audiobooks, and if you don't, you should, a good narrator can make or break the experience. Good narrators vary their voice. They know when to emphasize. They know when to overdo it and underdo it.
Now, as for funny, yes, do be funny, except when you don't.
Because the best thing you can do at a reading is have an emotional reaction from the audience. You know, have them laugh, have them gasp, have them engage with what you're doing.
You see, surprise the audience. If there are three comic Johnny Shaw-style gut rippers before you, drop in a dramatic tale, like the one I wrote for Jay's Replacement Anthology, about a mother cleaning the blood splatters from the walls that were left by her son shooting dope. They're real grim, but that's the point, see. It's all about rhythm.
I almost never decide what I'm going to read until I'm actually up reading it. I have at least two options going, and that's because I want to know the context in which I'm performing. If everybody reading before me has one tone, I'll kind of go the opposite, because I want to stand out, but also because I want the audience to be able to change gears a little bit. So if everybody before me is funny, I'll be brutal, and vice versa. If everybody before me is reverential, you know, they're reading something very solemn, I'll take the piss.
If other readers go brutal, like Tom Pitts reading about a .45 caliber enema, drop in a sweet, light comedy piece.
And don't pick something, by the way, with too many characters in it. A couple of characters or one character doing something, that's a good piece to be reading from.
One really important thing is to not over-explain. If you find you're spending a few minutes setting up what you're going to read, you're spending a few minutes too long.
Stick to your time. Leave them wanting more. Always. How do you know how long your piece is? Well, you practiced it, and you practiced it with a stopwatch. And if the piece that you want to read is too long, then read a different piece or cut it.
Even the best reader can go on too long. Keep it short, keep it punchy.
I always shoot for under the limit. Yes, you should read less than you're asked. Leave people wanting more.
End on a big note and leave a big impression.
The one other thing I want to throw in is that know who your audience is. If there are children there, don't read that piece that you have that uses the F-bomb every two words. Also, remember this about your audience. They came to have a good time.
The audience hasn't read your piece. So if you fumble a word or lose your place, ad lib. I mean, that is, make shit up. You will get back to the text, and no one will be the wiser.
They want you to succeed. The critics aren't there. The critics will be reading your book and saying nasty things about it on Amazon, because that's what they do. But they didn't come to your reading. Your friends came to your reading. Your fans came to your reading. The people who are curious came to your reading. Give them a good time.
Stand up there. Don't pre-qualify about how you suck at reading. Take the stage like Jay fucking Z. And don't stop until you drop the mic.
Okay, so that was Puppy P.I. And now on to this week's guest. Who we got?
Art Taylor is the author of On the Road with Dallin Louise, a novel in stories, winner of the Agatha Award for the best first novel. He has won three additional Agatha Awards, an Anthony, two McCavity Awards, and three consecutive Derringer Awards for his short fiction. His work has appeared in Best American Mystery Stories. He edited Murder Under the Oaks, the 2015 BoucherCon anthology, which is winner of the Anthony Award for Best Anthology or Collection. He is an associate professor of English at George Mason University and contributes frequently to the Washington Post, the Washington Independent Review of Books, and Mystery Scene magazine.
Join us as we talk to art.
One of the things when people come on, we like to, you know, everybody knows who you are, of course, but we like to read the intro and everything. So generally in the pre-taping, I read the bio so that, you know, if there's anything wrong or correction, you know, you let me know and we can edit that in. So here's what I have. Art Taylor was an American jazz drummer who, quote, helped define the sound of modern jazz drumming, end quote. Born April 6th, so happy birthday upcoming, 1929.
Thank you.
Died February 6th, 1995. So, you know, we got a whole lot of questions here.
Yeah, that was my previous career. What's funny is I made a call one time to go to the Village Vanguard in New York, obviously. And was making reservations. And this guy, who sounded like an older guy, was taking the reservation. He said, "What's your name?" And I said, "That's Art Taylor." And he all of a sudden, there was this kind of a long sigh. He goes, "Yeah, I knew Art Taylor. And he used to come in here." And there was, and we bonded over this. And I was like, yeah, I mean, clearly he knew it wasn't the Art Taylor. But I was like, I felt like I had a kinship with this man because of his memories of the other Art Taylor. Yeah. And it's been my goal, I got to tell you, to get my on a Google search to get my name up above his. I mean, that is like a lifetime goal. I'm embarrassed to admit this. Please edit that out. But
No.
There was I forget when it was, several years ago, there was a guy named Art Taylor who apparently got, you know, picked up. He was smuggling drugs some kind. Anyway, I think he swallowed.
Sure. And was this the other Art Taylor?
The third Art Taylor, not the jazz drummer, not me. But no, and you can Google it now and you'll see him. And he, like, I think he swallowed a bag of some kind of drug anyway to try to avoid the evidence. And then his mugshot went viral because of the look on his face. He looked just like giddy, crazy, happy. Google it now. And you'll, and this guy is, and so all of a sudden it was like, you know. That was me for a while. It was like he was hard to get past, I got to tell you.
Oh, my God. I see exactly. Okay, so this is going in the show notes.
You should. It should, yeah. He was like, he was dominating. I mean, he was beating both me and the drummer, despite all that we've done. And, you know, and just moments he makes fame.
Yeah, I just looked at it.
Right? No, that's totally going in the show notes. This is, everybody listening, immediately go look in the show notes because it is indeed the best mugshot ever.
I want that as an author photo. That would be amazing.
I know. I keep waiting for somebody to pick it up accidentally, you know, on something.
Just imagine you flicking through the Mashicon program and you find that. That would be perfect.
It would be. You know, it'd be attention getting. It'd be something to talk about.
So this is great radio. We're talking about a picture.
A photo that no one else can see.
Well, they're looking it up right now because they're listening to it on their computer. They're like, all right, I'm here. Let me go ahead and look.
Well,
they're laughing.
At home.
Three people just got hit by cars because they were doing it on their phone.
Oh, yeah, doing it on the – yeah. See, I listen while I
okay,
do stuff.
Okay, so pull over to a safe place or stop walking before you look up this mugshot. Okay, so let's do not a smooth transition at all, and we'll come back and figure out a way to transition it more smoothly. But prequels. Jay and I programmed Left Coast Crime in Reno, and one of the topics, and it was inspired by Reed Coleman, really, that we had as a panel was, what's your prequel? You know, what, first of all, what books inspired you? What authors inspired you? But most of all, what character would you love to write? Like, if you could write any character that was not your own, you know, from the past, or I guess even present, maybe future if you're psychic, I don't know.
I mean, I read pretty widely. I mean, I was reading Agatha Christie at the same time I was reading Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. So it was like, for me, it was not that division that we think of, you know, where it's like, I mean, here, Jay, you're obviously on one end of the spectrum, this far away from cozy, and yet I don't know if you have, you know, when you were coming along, read any of those more traditional mysteries or what was like feeding what you're doing. For me, I was drawing on a lot of different stuff. So it's trying to think of, like, you know, if you think of those iconic figures of some kind, what I want to come back to. I don't know. There was a lot of lead up for no answer. but I think, I mean, Hammett, I teach Hammett, you know, I'm always coming back to him. so I was like trying to go through, like, you know, I mean, Nick and Nora Charles are just such delights to be with. And so part of me would be like wanting to come back to that. But probably the one that outside of those like classic, you know, kind of archetypal sort of things, I was one of my first adult mystery novels series that I read was a Travis McGee Mysteries by John D. MacDonald. And I just ate those up. I mean, it felt like there was something about that that world that felt very adult as a teenager, and even a little world weary in some ways, in a different way, in a more natural way, I think, than Chandler did. And so that character has always been one that not just fond of, but like spending time with. Mm-hmm. And I think it would be, and of course there have been attempts to, I think, to put those on, you know, TV or do movies, and they've all failed in some way.
Really,
I don't
interesting
think
that character, for some reason, every time they try it, just it doesn't work. They can't capture whatever it is that you know is on the page that works.
Yeah, I mean, the closest they got, I guess, is not a Travis McGee, but is Rockford Files. You know, Rockford mm-hmm. has that kind of feeling about him. To some degree, it's not the same character, you know, many differences, obviously, but there's something that echoes in there. I think it's the closest that maybe you got to it. But to go back and sort of, you know, revisit that. In fact, I've thought about it. I mean, I, like I said, I grew up in North Carolina. I spent a lot of time on the coast. And I think that there's something about living, you know, being on the coast, being on the beach, that setting speaks to me a lot. And I'm, you know, so mm-hmm. I could see doing something like that. I don't know.
Stuff that's also kind of hardwired, I think, from that character, it's kind of hardwired into crime fiction that we don't think of as, you know, we don't always trace it back to that's who did that. But I mean, recently I was coming up with a character who was basically Jim Rockford, because I love the Rockford Files. But yeah. I kept coming up with all these twists that I could, all these fresh things, and I could go, okay, well, he lives in New York, but he lives on a houseboat. You know, and everybody I mentioned that to said, well, you can't do that because that's Travis McGee.
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought of Travis McGee in about 10 years at that point. So it was just, it was in there, you know, but I hadn't thought of it.
Well, there's something about, you know, about kind of living separate, of being, I mean, I think being on the water does something, period, to your psyche, you know. But the idea of you know, it's a different kind of living. It's a different kind of place. It's a different space. And I mean, it's a character that I mean, you can trace it back to Chandler, the idea of the knight errant coming in and saving people, and particularly women in the Travis McGee series. I mean, it's got a long history there, but there's something about him particularly that is very different from, you know, Marlowe or.
There's also, and I could be remembering this wrong, it's been so long since I've read them, but I think there's also something a bit more in that when he's upfront about what cut he takes, what percentage he takes of things. And that's something that I kind of think is often missing from crime is, you know, particularly with the Marlowes and those characters, we kind of mythologize the idea of not getting paid for things that you care about. Whereas, you know, there's a bit more with Travis McGee, you know.
There's a whole genre, you know, the amateur sleuths. Really, often they get nothing out of this unless they themselves are the person that's being suspected of the crime or someone that they love is. But these people who stumble over these bodies generally have no responsibility to or for them that would require them stopping their lives to, you know, investigate a crime mm-hmm. and put themselves in peril. Generally, there's no reward in this entire genre, which I think is interesting that we let that be gotten away with, kind of.
Yeah.
'Cause, I mean, would you stop, you know, if you stumble over, you know, a body somewhere that you know you didn't kill?
I step over them every time.
Right? Or are you like, no, I'm not going to go to work. I'm going to ignore my family and I am going to track down this killer.
Yeah. You know, I taught a Sherlock class at Mason last semester. And we talked about the number of times where he's like, I'm going to get paid. And the number of times when he's like, I do this for the love of searching for the truth or to right justice and all like that. And you get a balance there. I mean, sometimes he's like, hey, here's a paycheck walking up the street, walking up the stairs. And so you get that mix there where it's a little uneven. And we have to look at it and be like, well, why here this? Why there that? What's interesting about it, and go back to Travis McGee a little bit, is that he does. I mean, he's very upfront about here's what my cut is. Here's what my take is. Here's what this is going to be. And then over the course of it, sometimes he gets more personally invested in it. And that's going to drive him as much as something else. So you've got that stepping stone there. Otherwise, it's like, I mean, we've got, as you said, as you're hinting at, these characters and other mysteries who are just like, well, there's a body. I'm going to investigate. Why? Why are we doing that?
Yeah.
And I think it's that personal involvement, that personal, whatever's at stake, whether it is a personal investment in a person or whether it is, you know, here's something that's just not right and it makes me mad as hell. And therefore, I'm going to do something. But you got to be driven in some way. The paycheck,
right.
Maybe
so,
part of it.
So it's a motivation, but also there's an element of ego, I think, that we have to look at if we're talking. Apparently, I'm just having this conversation with myself. traditional mysteries. Because, you know, also, if you're a interior designer, do you really feel like you're qualified to investigate a murder? If you're a chef, you know, you don't really have the background. I get, you know, a PI who this is their job or a former police officer but, you know, so now they have no motive really for doing this because they don't have generally a personal relationship with the, sometimes they do, you know, it could be their sister or whatever, or neighbor, but often it's just a random thing that they happen to be in a place and stumble over the body. So no motive and a level of ego that's like, oh no, let me do this better than the people whose jobs this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who are these sociopaths? Like, <that's...
laughs> but that takes it back to Rockford again. It's just that, you know, one of the first things I always think of with Rockford and why part of why I love him is that, you know, you can instantly think of $200 a day plus expenses. And it was just hard. That was his motto. And I think it's the first episode is when it's someone hires him and he stands there and makes them write out the check before he does anything. And there's just a very realistic workmanlike thing of, no, you're going to pay me. And obviously most of the time he ended up not getting paid. But, you know, I liked that was in the character that of, you know, I'm not doing this for free. Okay, money bit. This week's sponsor is Riverdale Avenue Books, and tell us about the title.
This week's sponsor is Don Quixote by Lisa Trevor. In her third erotic romance mashup, Lisa Trevor brings us a femdom reimagining of Cervantes' Don Quixote. Dulcinea runs a nightclub that's part dungeon, part live-action theater. When mobster Gino de Pasamonte decides his money can buy the best dominatrix in the tri-state area, he's in for a big surprise when she puts him in a chastity cage and punts him out of her club, naked for disrespecting her. Now, Gino is out for revenge, and it's up to Dulcinea and her head of security, Alonso, to stop him from destroying chivalry, her reputation, and her devoted slaves.
Sold.
That PI genre is obviously alive and well. We can debate whether it's alive and well. It's alive. It goes back and forth between whether it's going to be you know really popular or not. But the traditional mystery, the Miss Marple tradition, for example, you know, Miss Marple has, does she have tons of ego? But she has tons of qualifications for solving something.
But also,
by having
most
lived.
Of the time, people approach her.
They
she
do.
Doesn't really seek out the mystery or the crime.
Yeah.
People are asking her to come. Oh, please come to the manor house. Somebody just died. Or, you know, and that's not the case every time. But I think the majority of the time she is sought out as opposed to spontaneously.
But you got that tradition of like the village mystery, the small community that is, you know, rocked by murder at every turn. And somebody who is not a policeman, not qualified for this, and people read that, people really connect to it, and I wonder why. I mean, I guess I can flip in the question. It's like instead of looking at the character, why are they? What drives them to do this?
That's an easier question because it's people exerting the level of control over their life that they'd like to have themselves.
Yeah.
So they'd like to be the person that would be the one that, you know, solves the crime or brings justice back, even though they don't necessarily have the qualifications to do so. So the reader is far more easily figured out on that one, I think, than the people who actually do it.
It's kind of like getting an adventure. And the same way we used to read, you know, Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys. It's like, oh, I'm a kid. I could do that. I could have those adventures, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I've always wondered. I can't remember if I've made this point ever on the show. I don't think so. I wonder with the PI side of it and with the, you know, with the tradition of the Marlowe, of the guy who ends up doing it for free because he gets invested in it.
Yeah.
To what extent is that the writers mythologizing ourselves, and because we always have the arguments about whether we should write for free, whether we should get paid. I don't think it should be an argument, but to what extent is it, is that the writer kind of justifying that we do, we end up doing things for the love of it rather than getting paid?
I never thought about that.
No, it's an interesting point. Yeah.
Whenever you said mythologizing, I thought you were going a completely different direction with that. I mean, you know, but yeah.
That's generally, you know, I always think of the, it is the white knight, the knight errant who does these things, you know, just for, you know, the good graces of somebody else or for a pure motive. And so having that quasi anti-hero who ends up having the heart of gold is really a very standard trope for centuries. I mean, even every time both of you mention this, and of course, as much as we can go back to Marlowe, et cetera, I always think of the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, you know, where he would often come in, you know, save a town for a price and then leave, you know, not having collected the money. You know, so that, that tough guy who does this, and in a way, Jack Reacher is the heir apparent to many of this. For that same reason. I mean, you have that, you know, tough, strong hero who comes in and represents an ideal or a thing, saves, and then leaves. I think it's fascinating that you brought the writer as a trope into it, because that's another discussion completely with the frequency that any artists are taken advantage of and not required, you know, well, you'll do it for name recognition as opposed to, no, it's a job just like any other. And we have fees for doing things.
That's happened to all of us, right?
Sure.
I turned down, I had an invitation to be in an anthology. I don't want to badmouth almost what the anthology is, but in a really interesting anthology that was tied into art and an art exhibition and the idea of here are different pieces of art in there and then write a little piece of flash fiction on it. And I was like, yeah, really cool. And and the pay was going to be like the book, you know, that was it. It was just a contributor's copy. And so I started working on it, really was like really into it. And then I get word that, hey, the cost of producing the book, because it was like this art exhibition book, was going to be more than they expected. So what they would do is just give us a discount on purchasing the book. And I wrote back and said, no, I can't do that. And they were, and the person was astounded. I feel like I'm circling around some stuff here, but the artist is the one that I had talked to, and he was just astounded that he's like, why would you not want to be a part of this? It'd be really cool. And I'm like, yeah, well, do you just give your artwork up for people? Oh, it's my next cover. You know, I mean, there was just a weird disconnect. We talk about this all the time. Like to interior decorator, and people are like, you know what, you've got a good eye. Why don't you come in and spend several hours decorating my house, you know, and pick out stuff, you know?
I teach writing a lot, which is apparently just the theme of everything I see on this podcast. But hey, did you guys know
that
I teach
a drink.
Writing a lot? So I'll get asked to go teach a class at X conference or X college or whatever it is. And they will generally say, okay, you know, here's your class, blah, blah. And I'll say, okay, great. You know, are you paying me an honorarium? Are you getting me out there? You know, do I fly out there? Do you give me a hotel or lunch or, you get to come for free to the rest of the conference.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I didn't want to go to the conference to begin with. And now I'm going to go get to work there and not get anything. It's like,
yeah.
It floors me sometimes, you know, that they, I don't know what they think. I mean, of course, I'm always happy to learn and listening to people give workshops, you know, for free is great. Don't get me wrong, but I'm not going to fly, you know, maybe across the country with that as, know the reason. I've lost days of work for nothing.
And there's one thing, it's like, if I mean, I get asked, I teach, and so I someone's get
you
asked
don't say
to, yeah to do I know I'm sorry it, yeah you know, but because of that, I get invited to do stuff at libraries and stuff like that, and if it's close by, it's like, all right, sure, I'll go. I mean, there's a possibility, obviously, that somebody's going to be like, hey, he was cool, I'll buy his book, I'll do whatever. But all of a sudden, you start talking about putting airfare in and hotel stays. I mean, that's a whole different, that's a whole different level of commitment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, and the same thing. And I think there's just also a level of, and I think I've made it sound like myself and probably both of you that I've dragged along with me here are all about getting paid for what we do. And it's not really even that. I think it's the level of respect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or what we do. It's not that I need the money. It's like that I would appreciate if you valued my services to a degree. You know, if I go to a convention, please, you know, if you're giving out a sack lunch, you know, maybe include me in that as opposed to that's an add-on. You know, it's just yeah. these
and
things.
Throw a pickle in too, right?
So. Right, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and of course, yeah. we all do things for free. I mean, we have friends who are interior designers and will say, hey, would you mind looking at these two sofas and telling me which goes better in this space because you're an expert? And I think that there's a level of that that you can do with friendship. Like, I'm happy, especially friends whose writing I like, you know, I'm glad to look at that and give my opinion on it or fix a area that is just not working for somebody. But the expectation without that level of respect, I think, is where we all have the problem.
I think you want to know that people value your time. So if you're helping someone out that you like, then it's kind of inbuilt that you think, you know, they value my time or my opinion. That's kind of built into why you're being asked. But
right.
if you're being asked to do something and you get the impression the person asking doesn't value your time and that's why there's
yeah.
nothing coming with it, I think that's when the alarm bells go off.
That's why I don't have any friends or talk to people.
But you know what? You know, I got to say, in the midst of all that, I really admire your move there to, like, save the interior decorator demographic of your listening audience by giving them a little shout-out about how good they are to offer, you know, some of their time, stuff like that. Because we were losing them.
We were, because I had them solving crimes with no credentials just moments
right.
ago. And I was like, I got to fix this.
Yep.
They were
yep.
they were just listening to the podcast and they were just stopping
they were
trying to solve the crime. You made them rethink their whole life. They're like, why am I even doing this?
They were preparing to throw pillows for the purpose they were named for.
I don't know about you guys, but I came up with a rule because I do stuff for free. I've edited an anthology when the writers wrote for free, and I host
yeah,
Noir
done.
Bar where people, you know, where people are coming and reading
for free.
I thought
you were going to say host a podcast for free.
I've hosted a podcast for free.
Wait, so y'all aren't paid for this? I'm sorry.
I know. But I kind of think if there's money, if somebody's getting paid, then I should get paid. If nobody's, so if it's an anthology when, you know, people are getting paid, then everyone should get a cut. Whereas if it's just, if it's something that you are do that everyone's giving some of their time for free, then I'm fine with that.
Absolutely. I think one of the most exciting moments for me, exciting things project ever working on, was editing the Bowser Khan anthology a couple of years ago. And I mean, I say got nothing out of that, got nothing monetarily out of that. It was a, you know, it's a charity thing and it was a volunteer project for me, but that was so rewarding in so many different ways. I mean, we can talk about this idea of literary citizenship and how that works and the many ways that we try to give back to a community that has given so much to us. But that's the standout for me. Was being able to take those writers and work with them and put that anthology together, what little role I had in putting that anthology together and getting it out there and being like, hey, this was good. I felt good.
So what's coming up next for you, Art?
Oh, I'm real excited. I've got a story in the latest issue of Down and Out, the magazine. It's a piece that was kind of inspired by Jim Thompson, actually, by the kind of the weird mood shifts, tone shifts in Thompson's work. And it's a real short story, about 1,000 words, a new issue of Down and Out. And then Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine is publishing a story called Fiction 398, or English 398 Fiction Workshop is the name of it, which is not based on my actual English 398 fiction workshops that I teach. But it is about a professor and a classroom and takes some dark turns. So that's coming out in, I think, the July August issue. So those are the two stories this year that I got coming up.
That's great. We look forward to reading those.
If you want to talk to us for
revenge,
you want to send us ransom notes,
Oh, actually, you know what, guys? Why don't you tell us your opinion of Jurassic World? And if you totally agree with me that Blue is the protagonist. Alternately, better idea. Oh, I'm on the fly here. Am I smart? Why don't you tell us the sequel for Jurassic Park you'd like to see?
Or prequel. Pitch us a prequel. Pitch us a prequel to Jurassic Park, which would basically be 65 million years worth of... Just pitch us a film.
With dinosaurs.
With dinosaurs. Pitch us,
yes. Dinosaur movie.
Although the prequel would be people in a lab making dinosaurs. Not that interesting. Unless it's got Mr. DNA involved.
Oh, Danny. Danny DNA.
Danny DNA. There we go. Oh, we need to tell people what to do. So if you want to do that...
Just think really hard about it. And we'll send it and come to you.
If you want to do that, you can get us at crimefriction@gmail.com. Or you can tweet us at...
DefectivesPod.
At DefectivesPod. All that's left is the bit when we have to say thanks to people. Probably people on the show, I'm guessing.
I would like to thank my sushi delivery man.
I would like to thank whoever it is who invented the burrito.
Ooh, good one.
Yeah. And I guess Art Taylor.